People had done just what we hoped. They'd taken the kind of genius of their local place and made it real, incarnate in these actions that they were doing. So Key West, only coral reefs in the continental U.S., coral reefs ecosystem in big trouble. If we can't somehow stop the oceans from warming, there won't be any coral reefs in 30 or 40 years. They didn't do a terrestrial demonstration. They got lots and lots of people in scuba gear, and they went down and did this demonstration in big signs in front of the coral reefs. And it's like, it's unbelievably beautiful. A big sign, cut carbon 8% by 2050. Big fish swimming through the middle of all these demonstrations, you know. It was gorgeous. A little further up the coast in Jacksonville, Florida. I've never been to Jacksonville, Florida, but my guess is that it's not exactly like Ithaca there, okay? And what they did, their sort of sacred ground, was the parking lot of the Jacksonville Jaguars NFL stadium, okay? Because that's where they have huge tailgate parties every Sunday in the fall. Well, this was the spring, and they took over this parking lot, and they got a crane, and they winched a yacht 20 foot up into the air. They said, see that? When Greenland slides into the ocean, that's where the ocean's going to be, okay? And you could almost just, from 1,000 miles away, hear sort of people going, oh, I get it now, you know? That makes sense to me. I understand that. I was in Lower Manhattan that morning, and thousands of us gathered down in Lower Manhattan, and we were all wearing blue shirts. And we made this sea of people, joined hands, and showed where the tide line would be if the oceans rose up 5 or 10 feet, you know, in the most valuable real estate in the world. Out west, they went on these, people did these, you know, all kinds of things all over the place, but one of them was these teams did these multi-day ascents of these glaciated peaks in the Rockies and the Sierras, and then skied down in formation and like webcasting as they went and all of this, to demonstrate the fact that those glaciers aren't going to be there in 10 years, 15 years, something like that. That's what we're losing. Well, it was really powerful to see all this. Powerful enough to convince us to try to do it again this fall. We're doing it slightly differently. We're trying to have, we're not going to have quite as many of them, at least I think we won't, because we're trying to make them a little tiny bit more focused. And what we're trying to focus on is getting as many politicians as we can to come to these, as many senators and congressmen and candidates for those jobs to come to these gatherings and react to the sort of plan that we've laid out, this 80% cuts, this no new coal, this green jobs program. We need, in short, to find out which politicians are planning to be leaders about this, you know, because we desperately need leadership on this if it's going to happen in the time it's going to happen. So some of these actions are taking place in places designed to sort of bring that out, you know, the kind of leaders, places that are associated with great leaders of the past. So there'll be people, some people up on the top of Mount Washington. I don't think there'll be too many politicians up there, but Rachel Carson's birthplace, or, you know, just all over the country, people figuring these things out. There's going to be one of them down in Ithaca. Chris, where are you? Where is it going to be in Ithaca?
Tunelo Park, town of Ithaca Park on the far side. There may also be an on-campus event for folks who don't want to walk that far, but it is a nice bike ride, and we're hoping to have a bicycle ride through Ithaca to Tunelo Park.
Chris, who helped organize the April 14th one and is a great organizer, is going to be taking names from people here. Sign, so you'll be right outside, yes?
Right outside
the door. Sign up so that she can send you an email telling you just the plan. For those of you on campus, she'll be sharing the names from people on campus with whoever is going to be organizing one here. Hopefully you'll be able to coordinate, go from here to there or something like that. Between the two of you, you should be able to summon your congressman to come meet with you and try to turn your good congressman into a champion on these issues. I'm done talking. All I want to say is, I meant it when I said that if we have any hope of this thing working, it depends on there being a movement as passionate as the one that ended formal segregation 30 or 40 years ago. That was, in some ways, the greatest moment in American history, or one of them. And we've got to draw from it and from many other inspirations in order to try and solve this problem. Now, I got to tell you the truth. It's different in this way. There was never any doubt that the civil rights movement was going to succeed. No one knew when it was going to succeed, but nobody past a certain point seriously thought that we were going to be able to go on living in a segregated world. I don't know if this movement's going to succeed, because we've got a really horrible time limit that we're up against. And I'm not altogether all the time an optimist. You know, the name of the book that I wrote about this was called The End of Nature. There are no guarantees. No guarantees save one. Well, save two. One guarantee is that if we don't have a strong and powerful movement, then we have no chance. And we are going to see those changes with the implications they have for every person on this earth and every species on this earth and for the future of this earth for thousands of generations to come. And the other guarantee is that no matter how it comes out, those of us involved in this movement will find in that involvement a deep satisfaction that there's something that we're trying anyway. And it's an enormous pleasure just to be in a room filled with people who are part of that and part of that community. That's what feels like my community now to me, and it's very good to be in one of its really important outposts. So thank you all very much.
You're listening to a talk by author and climate change activist Bill McKibben, given in Ithaca last week. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We continue with questions from the audience.
Thank you all enormously. We can do a few questions. I don't want to keep sort of abuse your patience and whatever, but we can do a few questions. And go on and check out the website, stepitup07.org, and see what people are doing elsewhere. It's fun, okay? So I have a few questions. Yes?
If we only have a few years, why don't we change it from 2050? Why let people think that they can do it by 2050?
Well, the goal that we're talking about is 80% cuts by 2050 and something on the order of 25% cuts by 2020. The Europeans have pledged to cut their carbon emissions 20% by 2020, and they say that if America will do 30% by 2020, they'll try to do 30% too. Frankly, that the Europeans are leading us on this should be a source of grave embarrassment. Because remember what I told you about how they already use half as much energy per capita? They're cutting into muscle now. The next 30% is going to be really, for us, you know, for us it's like, you know, losing weight by cutting your hair. I mean, we've got, you know, unbelievably easy stuff we can do right at first to get it done. So yeah, that's one of the emphases this time around is quick cuts. Get this process rolling, because you're absolutely right. If you say 80% by 2050, but you wait until 2040 to get started, then it's A, too late, and B, an awful big lift, you know. In fact, there's this emerging coalition, this sort of movement is that we're sort of helping set up, but it's taken in a lot of regional groups and things, and the youth movement too, this emerging coalition called One Sky. And they have a website, or I think they have, Carlos, is their website up and running yet? It should be soon. And they're sort of taking the job now of formulating the kind of demands of the climate movement. But that you're very right. That's very much on the list.
Can you share with us some stories about communities that have tried, towns that have tried to go off the grid and tried to have up their own energy, alternate energy sources that are more, like the farmer's market, that are more self-contained within their community?
You know, the question is about sort of local communities that have tried to become more self-sufficient and things. And, you know, that's actually, this most recent book of mine, Deep Economy, was really about the need for and the move towards much more localized economic institutions, food and energy and things being important. There are places that have begun this process. You can really see some of them in Scandinavia, places, entire towns and counties and things that have managed to become carbon neutral, that get all their power from local windmills, things like that. They're not yet really powerful examples of that in this country, but there will be soon. And people are starting to move in those directions. The peak oil movement has done a good job of sort of organizing people in various towns to think more about those kind of questions. That's good.
I used to be an anti-nuclear power activist. What do you think of James Lovelock's insistence that we go on a crash development of nuclear power?
More nuclear power plants, is that the answer? Look, one of the good things about talking about nuclear power is that it helps us to recognize just how dangerous coal-fired power plant is. That is to say, you know, we all understand what the risks of a nuclear power plant are, right? We know it's risky and scary and things, something could go wrong. If you put up a coal-fired power plant and it works the way it's supposed to, it destroys the earth. There are 150 coal-fired power plants on the books right now in this country. If any significant percentage of them ever get built, then this conversation is moot. That's why no new coal is a key demand. That said, I think nuclear power is going to play a small role in this transition, less because of its safety issues, though those are very real and very clear, more because it is ungodly expensive. If you give me the $3 billion that it takes to build a new nuclear power plant, I can show you 10 ways to get more carbon bang for the buck than building a new nuclear power plant. And it also takes a long time to build any appreciable number of them. That's time and money that we both lack, okay? And so, you know, for me, the greatest risk at this point from nuclear power is less fallout and plutonium and, you know, all of that. The greatest risk is distraction, that it's going to take time and money and attention that we need very much to be spending on other things that are more quick and comprehensive solutions to the problem that we're in. Conservation being the single most obvious, cheapest, and easiest. If you got money, that's where we should be spending it right now.
The other night, my fiance and I saw Thomas Friedman's new film, Green is the New Red.
Right.
And sort of his premise is that industrial capitalism will fix. We just need to continue to consume, and industrial capitalism will fix the global climate effect. And so I'm wondering a little bit if this is, you know, can't really try to discredit global warming anymore without being a whack. Is this the new sort of resistance movement that we've got to deal with?
That's a good question. And in Tom Friedman's case, I don't think so. I mean, I think he's sort of sincere. He's been pushing everything to do with globalization forever. You know, it's his mantra. He has a single idea, and he sticks to it, come what may. Although even he's become sort of chastened. He had a column last week talking about how fast development was going on. He was talking about someplace in the Middle East, Doha, or someplace in China, and just like this is getting out of control, you know? I mean, and there's no question but what he has some part of the answer there. There is no way in a world this influenced by, halfway governed by corporate power, that we're going to be able to make this transition without taking that corporate power into some kind of account, you know? They're going to have to play a role in this. And in fact, the bottom line question is, whether or not governments, and particularly our own, retain enough sense of their own authority to kind of begin to try once again at something we haven't done for 30 years, which is meaningfully guide what corporate power is going to do. You know, that's what this question about caps on carbon emissions is going to come down to. Whether or not, you know, and there are corporations who, because among other things, they're exposed to public opinion and regulation in the rest of the world, there are a number of corporations that are more amenable to this than others. The ones that are completely unwilling to go along and where the fight is just going to be bitter and endless is in the energy sector. If you own coal mines, there's nothing good that's going to come out of dealing seriously with global warming, you know? And so, and the power in that sector is not to be underestimated. ExxonMobil made $40 billion in profit last year, more profit than any company in the history of profits. In the system that we've set up, that's more than enough to ensure that you own a reasonable slate of congressmen and senators, you know? And the only way to win that fight, I mean, we could probably pool all of our spare change and still come up somewhat shy of $40 billion. And hence, it's only by acting in union politically that we have any hope of counteracting that kind of power. So if government can shape corporate response, then that'll be part of the solution. In the long run, I think the logic of a different energy world leads us away from huge globalized corporations and toward much more localized economies. I hope that that's what happens eventually, and I think that's where the logic of things eventually leads us. But in the meantime, in an emergency, we take every, you know, we got to use every, and it's one of the reasons that this movement is difficult, you know. You know, people often say things like, well, we can't do this until we've gotten rid of capitalism, or we can't do it until we've, you know, have a new sort of religious outlook on life or whatever. Well, you know, those things don't happen in 8-year periods, you know. We got to work with what we got. And happily, you know, there's enough stuff in the Bible that we can work with that we're now working with it, you know. And there may be enough stuff in sort of corporate structures that if government will finally stand up a little bit to that kind of power, that we'll be able to make some use of it. We shall see.
I was glad that you mentioned the Clinton-Gore years. What happened there? Somebody who knows as much as Al Gore turns out to know, do you blame them or the politicians? Or the people who bought the SUVs, or what went wrong? That was a disappointment. You could expect what would happen from the Bush regime. And the second part is, if the current crop of candidates out there, who do you see as most likely to give some real leadership?
Well, to the first question, I mean, you know, I don't pretend to know exactly what happened in the Clinton years, but pretty clearly, Bill Clinton was a liked to please people. And what was pleasing to me, you remember what his slogan was when he ran for president? It's the economy, stupid, you know? And he decided, faced with the various possibilities, that the thing he was going to stake his presidency on was economic growth in the short term. And in fact, he did things that no Republican president probably could have done, NAFTA and GATT. You know, able to get the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, through successfully. That's his legacy, and a lot of that legacy has to do with the, you know, runaway consumption now in the developing world. So it's a very, you know, it's a salutary lesson. I don't think Al Gore had an enormous amount of say in all of that, and I think since then, you know, I mean, I think, but I do think that he made a bad mistake in running away from these issues when he was running for president. I think since then he's been one of the great leaders that we could ever have hoped for. And his ability to talk about these things in ways that reach all kinds of people has really been magnificent. And I, you know, he's the man in those ways. As to the current crop of candidates, nobody yet has demonstrated that they're going to be, that this is going to be the centerpiece of what they're talking about, which really it needs to be. And that's part of why we're doing this Step It Up thing. We've got invited, and we're having, there's a tool on that stepitup07.org website that will allow each of you to go and easily send an email to each of the presidential candidates one by one, inviting them to come to your demonstration. Okay? And people are doing that all across the country. And we want to get them out on record. And I think we'll get at least some of them to do so. The person who's been best about it so far is John Edwards. He's been most forthright. He came and gave an excellent talk at the Step It Up rallies in April and announced in the course of that that he was signing on to this 80% by 2050 thing. Both within about 2 weeks, both Hillary and Obama matched him, sort of signed on too. But, you know, we have yet to see, and I guess the real way to answer this question is, it makes less difference who wins the presidency within certain boundaries than it does that there is an active, powerful movement that makes it impossible for whoever wins the presidency not to take deep action on this. That's what we're playing for. Clearly, nothing of real significance is going to happen in the last year and a half of the Bush administration. The first 6 months of 2009 will be the time when we find out whether or not we're going to mount a serious world, you know, first national and then worldwide effort to deal with this. And it's going to take someone who's able to engage not only the American public, but the world public to make that happen. And, you know, so we shall see. The point is, though, and this may harken back to the Clinton question a bit, what we don't need is incremental change around the edges. On this question, it doesn't do the slightest bit of good. You know, might as well not even bother. We need a transformative leader on this stuff. And that's what we've got to help emerge in the next, you know, 13 months or whatever.
So, Step It Up, Power Shift, Focus the Nation.
Focus the Nation, good.
How do we take our limited resources and our small body within a small university, I'm not from Cornell, energize students and faculty and community members and get them to, you know, allocate for all three, or you pick one?
No. I mean, this has got to be a movement, and movements have to keep on moving, you know? Some people, you know, some students will get on to Power Shift, and some other ones have to be here on campus and joining people in town. Everybody needs to come. January 31st is Focus the Nation, this nationwide teach-in on campuses across the country. And then there are going to be things after that, you know. That's how movements work. They have to accelerate and grow more powerful as time goes on. It's going to be hard in the next year to come because in our system, and a presidential election sucks a lot of oxygen out of the room, you know, and it gets harder and harder to focus on anything other than the kind of horse race kind of questions, you know, but we've got to keep that from happening. And frankly, we haven't yet, it would be my guess that sometime before very long, one of the questions we're going to be talking about is sort of nonviolent civil disobedience around these questions too. I was 5 or 6 or 7 years ago now, arrested in the first protest of any kind, first global warming protest in this country. This was another adventure in cluelessness because it was, you know, much before the time when anyone was really paying attention. But there was this demonstration, a little demonstration at Capitol Hill. And do you guys know who Granny D is?
Yeah.
This amazing woman who at the age of 90 marched across the country to demand campaign finance reform. Well, Granny D and I, she's an old friend, and we were there, and we were holding a banner that said, "Stop global warming, stop campaign contributions from global warmers," or something like that, in the Capitol. And so they arrested us and handcuffed us and let us out. And as we were going out, Granny D, who was that time was like 93 or something, looked up at me and said, "You know, I've never been arrested before. I should have started long ago," she said. So, and bless her heart, there was a student march across New Hampshire this summer. And the last mile into Concord, there was Granny D. We held hands and walked together. And she's now 97, I think, or 98, or something like that. So if she can do it, there's no excuse for any of the rest of us not to be, you know, helping in some way along this path. Let's do one more here. I don't want to keep you here all against your... You're out of kindness. You're very polite. But.
You implied the American way of life was going to change, but your examples were not real changes, but just kind of, you know, doing a little...
I think the American way of life is going to change a lot.
And I was wondering if you would describe that more than just, you know, hybrid cars and better insulation.
Well, look, I mean, food... local food is going to be how we feed ourselves more and more and more. The way that almost all people fed themselves for almost all of time, you know, and it'll be good. It'll be salutary change. We're not going to be able to keep building endless chains of suburbs sprawling further out into the countryside. We're going to be consolidating some, I imagine, and moving back in. That's a paradise of cheap oil, and it's not much of a paradise. Transportation's going to look different. There's no way to, if airline miles continue to grow at 6 and 7% a year, then we're not going to solve this problem, okay? We're going to need, if we're going to be moving around in long distances, we're going to need trains to make it happen the way that every other civilized country on Earth has a good train network. My friend Jimmy Kunstler said not long ago, he said, we have a train network that would make Bulgaria ashamed, you know, and it's true. There are going to be many changes, but the biggest of those changes is going to be in our sense of who we are. That hyper-individualism that was a byproduct of fossil fuel, the ability to just disregard everybody else around us, to not need to be a part of a community, to live in isolation, both physical and emotional, from people around us, that's going to come to an end. And that's not going to be, it's going to be wrenching and difficult in a lot of ways, but in the end, it's not going to be unpleasant. And this I really will end, you know, one of the things that's interesting, since y'all are in a college community, okay, one of the things that's interesting about a college, the most interesting thing about a college, the most interesting thing that gets taught here, you know how in the spring when the old grads come back to campus and they're all tottering around and going, these were the best years of my life, you know, that thing that you hear from people? It doesn't have to do with the courses that they took, you know, wonderful as those were, faculty. It has to do with the fact that college is the odd 4 years in an American life when Americans live the way that almost all human beings have always lived, i.e. in close physical and emotional proximity to other human beings. Okay? And so some of the experiments that are going on here in Ithaca are incredibly telling. Eco Village Ithaca is a really interesting place. One for me, one of the most remarkable realizations of the past year. My mother has reached the age where she needed to move into one of these retirement assisted living communities, whatever, out of her big suburban house and into that. And she's absolutely loves it. You know, she hasn't been happier in the longest time. And I've sort of been there to visit a number of times, and like the third or fourth time in, it sort of dawned on me that this was a commune. It just had old people in it, you know. They take their meals together, they have all this activity, they're all working on this, that. It's a commune. Well, you know, we're not going to have communes like people had in the 1970s where everybody, you know, just smokes dope and, you know, waits for someone else to do the work or whatever. But we are going to have communities again. We're going to have communities again. Because without the prop of endless cheap fossil fuel, we're going to have to depend on each other some again. And that's going to be a very interesting and in many ways very sweet world. It's going to come with all kinds of wrenching costs, and you know we're going to first go through a lot of damage, and it's going to take a lot of work for a lot of people to get there. But it won't be tragic in the end. Not if we do it right. Not if, in the process of taking on this fight, we begin to build those kind of tight and strong communities that'll allow us to prosper. Not materially, although we'll be fine, but humanly in the years to come. There we end. Thanks.
You've been listening to a talk by author and climate change activist Bill McKibben, given September 26, 2007, at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Thanks to Scott Perez and Matt Ryan for their assistance in making this recording possible. As McKibben pointed out, local food and farmers' markets are a delicious part of the climate solution. Listeners in the Finger Lakes are fortunate to be able to shop at farmers' markets almost every day of the week. In addition to the Ithaca Farmers Market mentioned in the talk, markets take place in communities including Watkins Glen, Trumansburg, Geneva, Waterloo, Montour Falls, Hammondsport, Bath, Corning, and Elmira, to name a few. You can find a list at the New York State Department of Ag and Markets by Googling New York Farmers Markets. Some people have the idea that farmers markets are upscale events for the affluent. Not so. In our area, the Ithaca Farmers Market and the Watkins Glen Farmers Market accept food stamps. The Watkins Glen Farmers Market is held Fridays from 2 to 7 in Lafayette Park, at the corner of 4th and Decatur in the village of Watkins Glen. The Ithaca Farmers Market is held at Steamboat Landing and DeWitt Park, open a variety of days and times. You can find the details on the web at ithacamarket.com. Radio EcoShock is an excellent weekly show hosted by Alex Smith at CFRO Radio in Vancouver. We're going to conclude the program with an interview Alex did with Gregory Green about his new film, Escape from Suburbia, his solution-focused sequel to his Peak Oil documentary, The End of Suburbia.
If you ask the question, do we have a plan for what we're going to do when we reach peak oil? The answer is certainly no.
Someone driving through suburbia should take a good look around, record the memory, because we may never see anything like it again.
Let's talk with Gregory Green, the director of the new film Escape from Suburbia. Gregory, your last award-winning film was End of Suburbia, but around here, new housing developments are sprouting up, I have to tell you, like mushrooms further and further away, and we have some commuters shipping their cars by ferry, even commuting from what used to be called cottage country. So, despite the gas prices almost doubling since 2004, people still don't seem to get the message. What do you think it's going to take?
Well, I mean, oil is still relatively inexpensive. I think today it's at $73, $72 some odd, and it if you look at a cup, it's still cheaper than a cup of coffee. It's got to get way more expensive. I think once we hit $100 or so, that will really start to engage the consumer.
$100 a barrel.
It's happening all over the place, you know, but here in Toronto it's the same thing. There's sprawl, you know, popping up all over the place.
Well, let's backtrack a little bit for people who missed the first film, The End of Suburbia. Why do you think suburbia is an endangered species, let's say?
Well, post-war suburbia was based on the conceit that we would always be driving cars, and that there was lots of land to extend out into and lots of energy to power a very low-density way of life. So we in the sort of, you know, the energy, the peak oil community, see the likelihood of that coming to an end as world production passes the peak and starts to, you know, perhaps incrementally and slowly, but decline in any case. So that'll raise energy prices up, and there'll be a big scramble for alternative energies. I think there's probably going to be a very serious recession or a series of recessions or worse. So all these things will put a real crimp on the suburban lifestyle.
And I guess another factor is everybody in China is either driving a car or wants to drive a car. We're going to have to compete with people that are actually producing something in other parts of the world.
Yeah, China and India are going to be huge competitors for the remaining oil and gas. And, you know, they don't seem inclined to start switching out to alternatives or, you know, really looking very seriously at the energy equation. So I think there's going to be increasing competition for the resources that are left. It's the wild card. The wild card is, will there be war between, you know, the great powers again, of China allied with, you know, parts of Asia and Pakistan. America allied with, you know, other parts of Asia and India and, you know, some places in the Gulf, perhaps. The other possibility is even closer to that is a Middle Eastern war. I think war is the real wild card in this. The war is the possibility. The increasing potential of wars make it hard to predict whether the global economy is going to be the, you know, straw that broke the camel's back, or whether it's going to be fuel prices.
Well, you know, I watched your film last night, and it kept me up a little late afterwards asking a lot of questions, and I guess that means it's a good film. One of them I was wondering about was just that, but in fact, I had a different take. I was thinking, well, maybe since the military is using so much oil, almost as much as consumers are using, the U.S. military is anyway, that we might head towards a little bit of peace in the sense that they just won't have enough oil to keep all the tanks and airplanes and Navy ships going.
Well, that's pretty optimistic. I try to be an optimist, and I think we try to reflect some optimism in our new film. There's only so much you can push people, which we did in the first film, into a, you know, sort of a catastrophic scenario. In this film, we're trying to say, look, whatever happens, there are solutions. There's people working on the solutions, and there's lots of things we can do. Personally, though, I think that if it starts coming to military confrontation, we have lots of oil left. I think that's the main point here. We've only gone through about half of the remaining oil, and peak natural gas will be coming along in the next few years. So we've got lots to power the world's military machines, and I think that's likely to happen.
They'll probably keep getting it after our pumps run dry because they have the power to enforce it.
Yeah. I don't know that our pumps are going to run dry anytime soon. Again, it's going to be the price. It's going to be, there may be scarcity, I don't know. But the price, I just don't know any thinking person looking at this who can't see the potential for skyrocketing prices. And I think that's the danger to consumers in the immediate future.
We have a lot of surprising people coming out on this issue now. I was wondering, former Governor General Ed Schreier was there, and he's worried we're going to run out of oil before we do anything about it. That was in your film.
A lot of the energy experts aren't worried about running out of oil anytime soon. Peak oil only means that you've used about a half of it. The danger is that the transition to the various forms of energy we're going to be replacing oil and gas with. The danger is we'll be doing that transition in a period of economic contraction and wars. So it's the transition. It's not running out that's the big danger. It's the transitioning to all these other forms of energy that's going to be the tough part.
And some of them take decades to develop.
All the various alternative energies take decades to develop. Right now, we're moving towards biofuels, and that's what we tried to talk about in our documentary, but, you know, the news is coming out all over the place for those who are inclined to hear it. The consequences of switching to biofuels are enormous. We're going to be producing less food, switching our food crops to power our vehicles. There's barely enough food in the world to feed the population now. World wheat production has been going down for the last few years. We've been going through our reserves, and we don't know if we've hit peak grain, but that's a possibility too. So, you know, the further consequences of going to biofuels is we're going to be really pushing out the marginal groups around the world that are dependent on those crops to eat.
In other words, some people may starve so we can keep filling up our gas tanks.
That's happening already. People are hungry. As you know, over the last 2 years, we've seen this you know, shift to biofuels. There were riots in Mexico City last year over the price of corn tortillas because the price of corn has tripled in the last few years. And the biofuel revolution hasn't even begun yet. So we see the writing on the wall there.
Well, you know, I come at this more from an environmentalist perspective, I have to say, and we do a lot of programs on climate change. And we see that in the Amazon, for example, they're bulldozing parts of the rainforest that we need very much, releasing a lot of carbon in order to plant soya for biofuels.
Yeah, we're using up one of the last biggest carbon sinks on the planet in Brazil and other countries to do that.
And I see in your film you have David Suzuki speaking out about peak oil too.
Yeah, you know, it's very odd. The leadership of the progressive environmental movement or the progressive left movement have been really mum on the issue of oil depletion and peak oil. I don't really know why. I think a lot of them have been so focused on climate change. And so maybe, you know, peak oil is kind of like the new kid on the block in some respects. The other thing is, I think, coming from a lot of the progressive movement is that a lot of people who are focused on the peak oil issue tend to be not environmentalists. They haven't been focused on climate change. They tend to be very conservative energy analysts and stockbrokers and financial people. So I think the two sides view each other with extreme distrust, whereas it's the same issue. It's our, you know, as President Bush said, it's our addiction to oil. So it's really, and this is what we tried to do in Escape from Suburbia. It's important for us to reach out and talk about climate change at the same time as we talk about peak oil and energy scarcity.
Yes, you had both Thomas Homer Dixon and the Green Party leader Elizabeth May talking about the possible convergence and the resistances of these two issues. Elizabeth May seemed to be suggesting that fossil fuels like coal and tar sands are going to outlast the ability of the climate to survive it, so that even if peak oil is an important issue, climate change may threaten us before we use up the last of the fossil fuels. What's your take on that?
Well, I think I sort of disagreed with what Elizabeth May said in our documentary at a certain point. She says peak oil can't happen fast enough for climate change. The thinking going is, as we hit peak, then we'll just be using less fossil fuels. But I think the danger is that as we hit peak and we've used up the easily available oil and gas, we're going to be switching to the dirtier hydrocarbons. The danger is very clear that way, because if we're doing this, during a period of a Middle Eastern war or more tension between the great powers, economic recessions or a depression, then people are going to be desperate to put the lights on any way they can. So the danger as we pass peak is that we will be exacerbating climate change, and that's a very real danger. So
one of the things I really liked about your film was that I didn't come away with it thinking that you had all the answers and I was supposed to, at the end of the film, get your answer. Just the fact right now you just said, well, I disagreed with something that was in my own documentary. It indicates that you really did cover a lot of different points of view and then left it for the viewer to sort it out. Well, what am I going to do?
This was the conundrum we were facing in the second documentary, is lots of people were really waiting for us to give them the answers. And I think we started out the film that way. I had things that I wanted to discuss and be much more sort of technical about it. That doesn't really lead to a very interesting dramatic arc in a film. That was one issue. But the other issue that happened over the last 2 years is that just a plethora of information started coming out about what we can do, about, you know, sustainable solutions. Here in Toronto, the Toronto Star has fantastic articles every day about you name it, you know, the 100-mile food movement, local eating, new solar technologies, green power, all these things. So it became clear to me that the answers were out there. You just need the will to do that, and you need to be talking with other people to compare the information that you're gathering, because the information's there. Who are we to sort of give a short list of the possible solutions when other people are doing fantastic work on it? We touched on that, of course, at the end of the film, the fact that, you know, the true energy revolution is going to be local, it's going to be distributed, it's going to be renewable and sustainable. But, yeah, it was very difficult trying to carve a story that would engage people out of all the sort of sustainability answers that are coming out. It was tough. But yeah, I don't agree with everything we said in the film. But I think it's a template for discussion. That's the whole thing. Like the first film, this film is designed to bring people who are concerned about energy scarcity, about peak oil, about climate change together and just get them talking.
And I thought it was gentle enough that if people got the DVD and played it for a bunch of friends, some of whom may have never even heard of peak oil, that discussion would take place. Is that part of your intent?
Yeah, absolutely. The discussion is to get as many people talking about this as possible. But, again, the overarching importance I see of the film is to sort of give people a sort of solid sense of the convergence of these problems that are coming together, a sense that there are many answers coming from a lot of different directions, and that people are really sincere about trying to address them. The three characters we have, the character couples that we have in our film, aren't meant to be, you know, Mr. Every Person, and we've been criticized for that. I think people want to see a sort of nice white suburban family, you know, buying solar panels and planting food. We wanted to show people who are thinking outside the box and in some cases marginalized. And the gay couple in New York are a pretty kind of marginalized demographic within the peak oil community. There's not, you know, a lot of gay folks around. Kate Holloway, our activist in Toronto, is not.
Well, she's a former business person who has really just done a 180, and said, "Well, I'm going to go green and dig in and do the best where I am." That's quite a turnaround.
Well, I'm glad that was clear in the film. That's what's important about her character, certainly, is that she's a lot more mainstream than the other two characters.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we didn't want to pander to that idea that we should be presenting, you know, the public with one particular story that has all the answers.
You've been listening to my interview with Gregory Green, the director of Escape from Suburbia. And hang on, there's more to come. We've got lots more discussion with Gregory Green.
It could easily be one of the awful tipping points in the history of the world.
I think there's many ways to survive and even thrive in the coming energy decline.
This is the Radio EcoShock Show. We're talking with Gregory Green, the director of the new film Escape from Suburbia. Your first film was fairly low budget, and yet it won some awards and became very widely distributed. I've seen it all over the place, including on television. What's your plan for distributing this new film, and how can people get a hold of a copy?
Well, what we found with the first film was, I mean, for filmmakers, it was really remarkable, and activists, because 3 years ago, 4 years ago when we started the film, I think oil, the price of a barrel of oil was in the $20 range somewhere, and nobody was paying attention to this. Nobody would fund it, nobody would, you know, broadcast it and come on as a broadcaster. We did it entirely on our own for a very low budget. I think we did it under $20,000. And I think our timing was fortuitous. It was lucky because oil prices started to inch up as we finished the film. And you know, within a few months of releasing the film, the price of oil was in the 40s and then the 50s, and people started to pay attention. They realized they weren't getting the answers from the mainstream media. They weren't getting anything from the mainstream media. So I think the idea of our documentary began to spread very rapidly, with people who are concerned about this. So for us, it was a great sense of satisfaction knowing that our documentary was being used at the very sort of beginning of a new movement, of a new activist movement. And they were using our documentary to, you know, spread the information and the ideas around that this was coming. So we wanted to, in the second film, show people who, you know, were these are the stories of some of the people who followed the end of suburbia, who were engaged by our first documentary. And we followed those stories. And this film is obviously trying not to repeat a lot of what was said in the first film. These are people working on solutions, and this is the sort of thrust of what we should be focusing on. Local food production. That's the elephant in the room, is food. Local renewable distributed energy. Powering down the idea that we either voluntarily or as consumers are just going to have to use up less energy, consume less. And that does not have to be a dour, unhappy event. It can actually be full of richness and connection with community. People come together in a crisis, and I think we wanted to show that.
One thing I did like about the film, too, was that instead of looking at sort of the Al Gore-type picture of big governments and what they should be doing internationally, we get to pretty well go into the living rooms and hearts of people just like ourselves and their confusions and the answers that they're coming up with. Now, you do have a couple who decide to leave the United States and go to an eco-commune in Canada. I see a lot of echoes in that to the 1970s Back to the Land movement. Do you think that there's a big difference in the two situations?
Between the 70s and now? Mm-hmm. What we see with those characters in our documentary is the evolution of that way of thinking. I think Jan and Carol were probably hippies in the 70s. And, they haven't sold out and become, sort of mindless yuppie consumers like so many of the other hippies did. They've actually kept and evolved their philosophy. So we see them using technology and using a technology appropriately, and I think that's the key to what they represent in the story. There are huge differences between what happened in the 70s and what's happening and going to happen now. Things got better in the 70s, and I don't think things are going to get better this time. I don't think the Western economies are going to expand as rapidly as they did in the 80s, because that's what really happened. A lot of these people, went back to the land, or they were taking, interested in the hippie idealism, and got high-paying jobs at the end of it, participated in a very rapidly growing economy. And I don't think that's going to happen. So I think people who are looking at alternatives will be this time. Over the next 10 or 20 years, we'll be in the forefront of how to adapt to all the shocks that are coming down at us.
They'll be ahead of the curve, perhaps.
I think so.
One of the characters, and I'm sorry I can't remember who, in your film suggests that we can't really escape from suburbia because there's just way too many of us. So what we have to do is adapt, and you do show in your film sort of what a new suburbia might look like if we took out the lawns and started planting the vegetable gardens there instead. Do you see that as the direction that many people will go?
I think the character in our film that you're talking about is Guy Dantzy. He's actually the head of the BC Sustainable Energy Association. I know people in the peak oil movement, the post-carbon institute and so forth, who think that what he says in our film is wildly optimistic. And I disagree. I disagree so strongly with that kind of thinking. There are many different options that suburbanized communities can and will be looking at. And the ones that do will prosper. And the ones that don't, I think, will likely collapse. But it's not a done deal that they all our sort of low density suburbs will collapse. I think there'll be lots and lots of them that find a new balance between a national global economy and a localized economy.
What is your personal take on this? Is Gregory Green developing a place to escape to if the gas prices get so high that none of us can afford it?
I'm working on it now. I'm half French, so I'm building a little place in the countryside in France, and that's where my heart is. It's probably hard for a lot of folks on the West Coast to identify with that, but that's my own particular solution. I think a lot of communities in Europe are going to be much more inclined and able to power down than, you know, communities in North America. I'm not saying it's going to be any easier in France than it will here, but I think that folks in Europe are used to the idea of limitation. You know, I know some very conservative friends in France who, you know, drive very small cars and have small houses and are just horrified with what we in North America consume. And these are very conservative people with conservative values. So I'm taking my chance and hanging my hat over there, I think.
Is there anything else you'd really like to tell us?
Well, the other thing is that the Escape from Suburbia is the second part in the trilogy. So in the third part of that trilogy, we'll be shooting that over the next 2 years. We'll be looking at bioregional solutions globally. So we'll be going to Brazil and looking at the biofuel revolution and what it's doing to the Amazon. We'll be going to Iceland to show what's probably going to be a functioning hydrogen economy because they have geothermal energy. And so we'll ask the questions, you know, well, that's great, but where are they going to get their food from? Maybe they're developing new greenhouse technology. So we're looking at how people proactively in different parts of the world are developing ideas that work in their bioregion and can be used elsewhere. So the idea, you know, is to look at the whole notion of global collapse, the fact that civilizations rise and fall, and we may be witnessing the beginning of the decline of our civilization. And what comes next? What are the answers? What is going to the basis of the next civilization going to look like?
How can people find out more, and how can they get a copy of your new film?
You just go to escapefromsuburbia.com, and you can order DVDs right from there. I think our documentary is still playing on the documentary channel. And that's about it right now. We're going to be having screenings. I think there's a screening out in Vancouver in a few days. Yeah, that's how we distributed the first film. We've distributed, I think, 35,000 DVDs of the first film just by doing that, just by people talking to other people. And we offer, bulk rates, so people want to buy the DVDs bulk and resell them. A lot of people were able to make some money doing that in the first documentary, and that's what we're hoping the model will be for the second documentary.
That spreads the word out further.
It spreads the word out further, and it helps actually, create some alternative financing for some of these groups. I know the Post Carbon Institute probably made a couple of $100,000 selling End of Suburbia over the last few years, so it's really helped them expand. And I think that it can help other groups too. So it's not just getting the message, the idea across, but it's also, just in terms of dollars and cents, a way to help us fund future documentaries and also to help groups fundraise.
We've been speaking with Gregory Green, the director of the new film Escape from Suburbia. Gregory, thanks so much for taking the time for talking with us today.
Thanks very much.
And that was Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. I recommend you investigate all of his excellent work archived online for free download at ecoshock.org. And you can download an MP3 of this program and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guests, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.